As you, they said yesterday, my name is Tibor. And that is my full name. And my email is. So your emails are permitinstitute.ca, but you can also. Shorten it, pitp.ca, that also works. And my room is 274. Okay. So, hey Josh or whoever is out there, can you like decrease the volume a little bit? Hello?
Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
No problem.
Awesome, thank you. So, the voice of God. So, I'll be teaching a course on. Is it Lie algebra and Lie groups? Or no, I think it's Lie groups and Lie algebras, right? All right, so a few words about the nature of this course. So the courses at the front end aren't really supposed to be very in-depth. Now, the thing is that none of the side courses are actually very in-depth because of the shortness of the courses, but these are more like, okay, let's do a review. And if you haven't seen it, these are the major concepts that you will need to understand the courses which are coming. Like, for example, when you do quantum field theory, there'll be a lot of groups. So people will talk about, Lie groups. Your lecturer will talk about the different representation, like the fundamental representation, adjoint representation, stuff like that. And, so the idea of this course is to give you some, exposure to those ideas so that at least you know where that is coming from, right? So hopefully over the years, you'll pick up more and more of these ideas. Now, for a lot of you, this will be a review. And for a lot of you, you probably have done a course which is very much an in-depth course on Lie algebra and Lie groups. So I apologize to those of you if this is boring, but I think, it might be you might actually learn something even if you have seen this before. And the other thing is that, at PSI, we always encourage people to work with each other. So if you think in the tutorial tomorrow, and also whenever you're hanging out in the PSI workroom, I always encourage you to talk to each other. And, if you have questions about something, ask the other side students. So, if you know a lot, please be generous with your knowledge, and help others, okay? And also, you can always come and talk to me and just knock on my door. I'm always available. And I am not a mathematician, so this is not an area of expertise. So there will be questions that I won't be able to answer, but I will try to answer them the next day or at least, point you toward the right references. All right. Let's start with a brief overview of what I hope to cover in this course. Oh, another point is that this is the second year I'm teaching it, and this course is still very much in flux. It is forming, so I don't have typed up lecture notes, but I have fairly legible handwriting. So after each of the lectures, I will, upload the lecture notes onto the wiki. Until you have access to the wiki, I will also email it to you. Okay? And there's a tutorial. There are four tutorials attached to this course. There's one tomorrow at 2:45 p.m. in the SCI room, workroom. And there'll be three more tutorials next week. Two of those tutorials, we will actually solve some, some group theory related problem. But the last one, what I'm thinking about is actually we are going to use that to have a question and answer, sort of an interview session. So as you know, the core courses in PSI, at the end of each core course, you have an interview. So I want to use the last tutorial as a kind of a mock interview, so that, you know, because for some of you, you might not be familiar with oral exam. So, you know, I hope that's okay, but I think it'll be good practice, because when the real interviews come around, you know, if you have done this a few times, it'll be a lot less stressful. Because in interviews, what we see is that almost no one is quote unquote unprepared for those interviews. You know, what trips people up are, you know, is their nerves, essentially. All right, so tutorial tomorrow. So at, sorry, it's not 2:40, I misspoke. It's at 3:45 to 5:15, okay? All right, so what are the contents of this course? So what I will try to do is, first I will start with some motivations. And we will cover some basic definitions. And important concepts. Just and also, although you know this is a course on. Oh, by the way, just interrupt me during the lecture if you have any questions. Okay. although you know this, most of this course will deal with continuous groups. We will start with, you know, discrete groups. I actually feel less comfortable with discrete groups than continuous group, because I guess my background. So I had to learn a little bit of discrete groups. But, you know, but I think, you know, some of these ideas, the fundamental definitions and concepts are easier to grasp in the context of discrete groups. And so what I'm going to write down, it's not necessarily going to be exactly in the order that we cover it, but, you know, although, you know, I'll talk about motivation, but I'll also talk more about how group theory, you know, relates to quantum mechanics. Basically, I will give you an outline of a famous theorem by Wigner, which, you know, makes group theory central to formulation of modern quantum mechanics. My friends in quantum information tells me that there's still a debate about whether how much group theory, not quantum foundation, I guess. Is that correct, Denis? Or that some people like use more group theory, some people don't. So apparently when quantum mechanics was first, invented, there was a whole school of people who didn't like, you know, using group theory. And anyway, but I think that debate has probably been resolved since then in favor of group theory. So then I'll talk about Lie groups and Lie algebras. I will give you like a very pedestrian way of relating Lie groups and Lie algebras, which is just expanding the Lie group matrix elements and getting the Lie algebra from that. But I will also give you a geometric overview of how Lie groups and Lie algebras are related. And that's an interesting, I won't give you a lot of details because it involves a lot of differential geometric concepts, but I will give you the overview. So I will give a list of some important matrix groups important as in important in physics, and I'll probably also talk about some applications to geometry. This is not exactly sure if I'll do it, but you know, so maybe. So for example, a lot of the spaces that we use that crop up in theoretical physics, such as, you know, S3 or ADS or other, you know, maximally symmetric spaces, very nice spaces, they can be thought of as coming from a quotient of two different Lie groups, you know. So I'll just briefly touch on how that's done, either in the lectures or in one of the tutorials. So one thing you have seen before, most of you, but I will do it again, because in last year's class, one person or two people actually hadn't seen it before, so it's worth doing, is SU2. And its representations. Okay, so the technique that you use to build up the representation of SE2 turns out it's the most useful gadget you have in the representation theory of Lie groups, because if you're going to build representations of other groups, you actually use this. So there's always like a little SU2 hiding in all these kind of, you know, other Lie algebras. I will also do some examples of Young's tableau. For SUN, SUN or SU2. Okay, then if time permits, do some tensor methods. For SUN, maybe SU2. And then what we'll do is that we'll talk about the roots and weights for, say, SU3, and if time permits, other stuff. So the classification of the classical Lie algebra is an interesting and a very beautiful subject, but I think we, from my experience last year, I don't think we'll have exact time to do the whole thing. So. But this will give you the flavor of what's involved in the classification. And you know, there are good books that you can read up about this thing. So, and this will not happen, but I just like this subject, so I will just write it down. You will see it in a quantum field theory one course probably, is that the spinner representations, the rep is a shorthand for representation of the Lorentz group. Okay, so maybe. All right, so any questions or comments so far? Also, another word of apology. Some of you in the audience have have seen a version of this course, because I taught a version of this course in an undergraduate summer school. So apologies to you if it's a lot of it is familiar to you, but I think some of it will be very new. Okay. All right, so motivations. We're stuck. Oh no, we are not stuck. Oh, that is stuck, okay. That must have been a while ago that board was written. It's way up there. Okay. All right, let's start with some motivations. Let's raise this a little bit more. Occasionally also, I will do some in-class group exercises, okay? Just to kind of, because otherwise it's just like boring, just you're sitting there, just listening, you know, talking. So it won't happen in every class, but you know, I will, some small exercise or something, okay? So let's start with some motivations. I'm sure motivations are not entirely necessary, but you know, I think your motivation might be different from mine, so it's good to go through this. So why are we interested in groups in general in physics? And that's because symmetries are fundamental to physics, right? So in theoretical physics, you know, we are studying systems which are not necessarily out there in the world, right? But they could be. So the symmetries that we study in our systems are reflected by, you know, they're actually reflected there out there in nature. Now, the way I understand it, you know, it would be foolish to be, say, try to formulate classical physics without any reference to symmetries, right? But it is possible. I mean, it would be extremely foolish, but it is possible, you know. Whereas in quantum mechanics, I think, you know, at least quantum mechanics that is living in space-time, it's impossible to even formulate, you know. So let me just like give you some examples of cool applications of groups in classical physics. Actually, I take that back, because I think that I think people don't use the language of groups, or they didn't used to use the language of groups in classical physics before, say, the 19th century, I think. But I think the notion of symmetry was always there. In fact, you know, there is the the boost. So by boost, I mean here Galilean boosts and rotational invariance. Translational invariance. Of Newton's law, right? Newton's laws. I mean, we don't. I mean, when we are taught physics as an undergraduate, we are not, you know, we are not told about the Galilean group, but it's there, right? And in fact, you know, if you read Galileo's original text about how he came with the Newton's laws, because the first two laws of Newton is actually by Galileo. He's actually talking about symmetries. You know, he's talking about how, if you know, like, because, you know, he understood the symmetries, you know, which led to the idea of, say, like an inertial frame, right? You know, the formulation, the definition of an inertial frame is in some sense a it's a statement about the law, Newton's laws being invariant under the Galilean boosts, right? Right. That the laws of physics doesn't matter if you're in whatever reference frame you are, right? Like, and and then you know, Einstein's discovery of special relativity, you know, in 1905, you know, it stems from a deep appreciation of the symmetries of Maxwell's equations, right? Away with the ether. So Emmy Noether discovered a deep link between symmetries of classical, you know, field theories and conserved quantities. Such as energy and momentum. Okay, so these are my list of classical, you know, my favorite examples of symmetry in classical physics. What are yours? Yes, please.
I know if it applies, but sometimes we can solve a problem or provide some arguments with symmetries argument, and it can really simplify the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, just like application. Sorry, remind me your name again.
Benjamin.
That a lot of times, you know. So, in fact, I think you know that's exactly how one of the motivations behind the construction, you know, the invention or the discovery of Lie groups was that, I mean, Lie was not a physicist, he was a mathematician, and I think he was trying to solve differential equations. And so the, you know, looking at some, finding some symmetry often allows you to solve a problem that you initially thought was too difficult, right? So, yeah. Anyone else?
Thank you.
Yes.
I remember in electrostatics, this method, I just Googled it, it's like image charges in English. You have a conductor and you basically duplicate that
right.
symmetry.
Yeah, yeah, that's a very nice, the method of images, right? I love the method of images. Now, which is actually like a kind of, you know, a subset of this. Some people don't like the method of images. For example, there's a very famous electrodynamics textbook, undergraduate textbook by Purcell. It's a very beautiful, and he describes it, and then he says, "Oh, it doesn't solve that many problems. It's more like a solution looking for a problem." But I think it's very, very, very nice. And at least when, you know, so one of the problems is that, you know, if you take an a charge on a, above a conducting plate, infinite conducting plate, you know, what are the lines of force, right? And, you know, then you can use the method of images and, you know, things like that. Yeah, but I think it's a very nice. Anyone else? Yes.
It's not really a symmetry, but sometimes we have ruptures of symmetries.
Sorry?
We have symmetries that are no longer, since we have a breaker.
Oh, you have a broken symmetry, yes. No, that is amazing, yeah. Like, broken symmetries are, you know, nature mostly kind of, you know, like a lot of times, even in quantum mechanics, you know, there will be some perturbation, you know, which will break the symmetry, and that allows you to solve, you know, because you, it's, you know, as, you know, as, you know, as we've been discussing, having symmetry helps you solve a problem, and then if it's broken in a very small way, then we can have perturbation series. So for example, you know, the helium atom, because we know how to solve the hydrogen atom, we can actually solve perturbatively the helium atom because it's a perturbation on the hydrogen atom. But there's also a more profound way of breaking symmetry and the whole idea of spontaneous symmetry breaking, hidden symmetry, you know, which leads to Higgs mechanism that is also, you know, so nature sometimes has symmetry, but nature likes, you know, hiding it, right? So that's also, anyone else or, okay. All right, let's move on because, you know, I still want to say a few things about quantum mechanics, symmetries in quantum, let's call it quantum physics because classical, you know, quantum field theory is. So my claim is it's impossible to fully, you know, formulate quantum mechanics without, you know, reference to symmetries. And what I mean by that is, I think, you know, people who do quantum foundations, sometimes they look at very, very simple systems which do not have any reference to any space-time, it's some Hamiltonian, and things like that. In those cases, you know, probably you can, you know, toy models, you can probably get away by without referring to symmetries. But, you know, stuff like whenever we do a rotation on our quantum system, you know, that's implemented by some unitary operation on some Hilbert space and things like that, right? So the whole idea of symmetry is kind of built into the fabric of quantum physics, and there's a theorem by Wigner which we will discuss, but maybe not today, tomorrow, maybe the day after, gives an insight into the structure of you know, how the structure of quantum mechanics involves group theory. So there's another theorem by Wigner, where he, and this is not something that I will cover in this course, but he classified, you know, the classifications of particles according to, say, the representations of the Poincaré group. And if you haven't heard what the Poincaré group is, I mean, I will cover this. Poincaré group is a group of symmetries of our space-time. And Wigner found that, you know, there are different, you know, so for example, massless particles will fall into, massless particle with particular spins will fall into a different representation than a massive particle, which has, you know, with or without spin. So that's a very, very important classification. And what Wigner found is that there are classifications of the Poincaré group which are not realized in nature. Or a better way to say it would be there are classifications in there are like classes in Wigner's classification which we do not see in nature. You know, nature doesn't use those. And, you know, so several years ago, you know, we used to have a couple of particle physicists who have now left, they've moved to Stanford. You know, Natalia Toro and Philip Schuster, they built a model of, I think, dark energy or dark matter, one of those two, on one of these other classifications called the continuous spin classification. So people are still trying to figure out whether or not, you know, those things will have some applications in nature. And as theoretical physicists, of course, it is our job to explore such possibilities, you know. Maybe, you know, it's not in our universe that this happens, but in some other universe that happens. So that when we do build that, you know, spaceship that can go to a different realities, we'll be prepared. Write that in your funding application, right? So in quantum theories, in, say, quantum field theories, so we also have some internal symmetries that lead to, say, conserved charges, you know, according to Noether's theorem. And for example, the electric charge can be thought of the conserved charge associated to a phase symmetry. So I should say a global phase symmetry. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, the Noether's theorem actually plays a very important role in quantum field theories. And in quantum field theories, we have these things called internal symmetries. So internal symmetries are symmetries which are not of a theory, which are not associated to space-time symmetries. So, you know, because we live in, well, we live in Minkowski space to some approximation. So we expect, you know, according to Wigner's theorem, we expect, you know, the symmetries of those space-time to be incorporated in our theories. But these theories will have some other symmetries which have nothing, no reference to space-time. And Noether's theorem tells us that internal, okay, so these are usually internal symmetries, but they're continuous. So Noether's theorem tells us that there are conserved charges. And you can think of the electric charge as a charge associated to the, if you multiply the field, such as the field that describes an electron, by a phase. Like, if this is a field that describes the electron, and if you multiply it by global phase, global meaning that this theta doesn't depend on any space-time point, Noether's theorem tells you that there's a conserved charge associated. Okay, so if you multiply it by this phase, the theory doesn't change. All the phases cancel out. And then Noether's theorem tells us that there must be some conserved charge, and that conserved charge is actually the charge of the electron. Okay? So, okay, I think that's enough waffle. But I want to end with one other symmetry, which is a very exotic kind of symmetry, and this is known as supersymmetry. So this is a symmetry that has not been observed in nature, and it's a certain, you can write down some theories where you can transform the bosons into fermions and vice versa. And supersymmetry is a symmetry that is necessary for the formulation of string theory. Supersymmetry has been proposed as a solution to certain particle physics problems, such as the hierarchy problem. But we haven't discovered supersymmetry in experiments, so it is falling out of favor rapidly from a phenomenological point of view. But string theory doesn't work without supersymmetry. Supersymmetry also introduces a notion of superspace, which is a generalization of space-time, which now has a fermionic component. And in mathematics, supersymmetry actually has a role to play, because a lot of the theorems, famous mathematical theorems about topology, can be proved very easily using supersymmetry and things like that. Okay, so all right, so I will finish my motivation here. Unless you guys, do you guys have something to contribute in terms of quantum mechanics? Yes, please.
Maybe just add next to the theorem by Wigner, that also like a very, very fundamental place. I mean, the Stone theorem. Stone theorem is barely engraved into the fundamental structure of quantum mechanics, which is the theorem that allows us to, out of strongly continuous one-parameter unitary groups, find observables. So that's kind of a very straightforward way of constructing observables.
All right. So can you remind me what the precise formulation of Stone's theorem is?
So it says that if you have some strongly continuous one-parameter group, so a bunch of unitary operators.
Yeah.
Depend on T.
Right.
You can differentiate them and obtain a self-adjoint operator.
Okay. Right.
So
okay.
You have like spatial translations that will be a strongly
right
parameter group.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. So basically, the relationship between say a unitary one parameter. Unitary transformation and, you know, the
observable.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's very, very good. Thank you.
Continuous parameter.
Strongly.
Well, yeah. One strongly, did you say?
Strongly. One parameter is strongly continuous. Yeah, there's a bunch of.
Okay, strongly continuous. What do you mean by strongly?
So there, you can consider the continuity of that in various topologies. The strong part means to do with the fact that you're measuring continuity by using the norm, not the operator norm, but rather the Hilbert space norm.
Okay, I see. Okay.
Porting a bunch of seminars from the Hilbert space.
All right, cool. Okay, cool. Thank you. Yeah. Anything else?
We can also use symmetries to actually develop R theories, right? To guide us in trying to describe some sort of phenomenon by postulating some sort of symmetry.
Yeah, exactly.
Like this. So
yeah.
It helps us like build theories, I'd say.
Yeah, it helps you build theories. In fact, some people would say that, you know, the search for fundamental theories of nature is actually a search for the right symmetries, because a lot of times if you can guess what the symmetry of your theory is, you know, because you can write down all, it constrains the number, the terms you can write down, right? So it helps a lot to, you know, aid what theory, what theory you're gonna have. All right, so.
That wobbled a little.
Oh, yeah, it wobbles, yeah. It's an act of fate that I actually put my finger over there. Or stupidity, you know, depending on how you say it. Okay, so. I'm not going to write anything down, but say a bunch of things about this now, is that, so in mathematics, you know, the symmetry, the mathematics of symmetry is encoded in groups, in the mathematical object of groups, right? But in physics, you know, we are interested in how these groups act on physical systems, right? In physics, usually what we have is we have some state of a system, and the state is usually represented by some, you know, some vector space, by some vector in some vector space. So then the action of the group on the system is is some linear operator. So the action of the group is some, you know, linear operator on the vector space, on the vector space. So in physics, what is important? So this linear operator may be finite or infinite dimensional. It could be a differential operator, it could be a matrix, it could be a finite dimensional matrix, it could be an infinite dimensional matrix, depends on the system, right? So what we're interested in physics is how this linear operator acts on this vector space. In other words, we're interested in the representation. We're interested in representation representations of the group. And this is like, it's impossible to overemphasize this. So for example, you will see that in strong interaction, there's a group called SU3, which is your symmetry group, and the quarks and the gluons, they form representations of SU3. But we don't see quarks. What we see is that we see nucleons or hadrons, which are bound states of these quarks. So to find the hadron spectrum, what we have to do is that we have to say, oh, how do the, you know, so some of these quarks say, you know, how do, you know, they form a three-dimensional representation of SU3. So, you know, we'll have to say, oh, how do these two different or three different quarks come together to make a hadron? This is, in some sense, this is a generalization, this kind of technique of, you know, or what you've already seen in undergrad. In undrad, you've seen how to combine angular momentum. It's known as the Clebsch-Gordan series. You know, representation theory is essentially a kind of a huge, like a math, a generalization of, you know, of that kind of mathematics. Okay, so, All right, so let's start with some fundamental concepts of groups now. So we actually now have to do some work. Right, so let's start with some fundamental concepts. A lot of the like concepts and definition I will introduce in the context of some example. So first, what is a group? It's just to, you know, you probably know this, but this is to set the notation. Okay, it's a set. So it should. So a group is a set G. It's equipped with a binary operation. So binary operation, you know, called the group multiplication. So I'm just gonna, you know, abbreviate group by GP. The group multiplication. And initially, I'm going to give it a symbol, a little round symbol, but then a weird. And this is basically, by binary operation, I mean it's a map from G cross G to G. You know, such that the following, following hold. So one is closure. So if both A and B are, if both A and B are in G, then so is A times B. The group multiplication is associative. And this is actually related to the fact that if we are thinking of groups as, you know, operations acting on some physical system, after each operation, the physical system has some well-defined state. So for all A, B, C, so there exists a unique element called the identity element. Identity element. So there exists an element which we denote by E, such that A times E is A for all A in G. And inverses also, so for all A, I guess I can just write it like that, for all A in G, there exists, or for every A in G, there exists an element A inverse of G, such that, okay, known as the inverse of A, such that A times A inverse is E. Okay. So from now on, we are just going to drop this multiplication sign. If you write A B, that means A multiplication B. Okay. So some comments are in order. So the way that I have defined a group is that the inverse and the identity element are really right inverse and right identity, because they are multiplying it from the right. Now, they're actually also left inverse and left. You can show that they are also left inverses and left identity. So I want you to take a couple of minutes and prove to yourself that the left inverse is also the right inverse. So, you know, prove that you know, this is what we have shown, but prove that this is also true. Just take a few minutes and see if you can show it.
Stefan?
Yeah?
Is the fact that the identity element is unique part of the axioms?
Yes, I think. Yeah. Let's give the others a minute. All right, any volunteer to come and please? Or just give another minute then. So, I mean, some of us are not used to thinking in that set theoretic term, so I think it's these are small, nice exercises too. All right, I need a volunteer.
It's because it doesn't seem like when I first saw it, I didn't think it was possible. But so what we do know is that A inverse equals Z, right? So we want to calculate now A versus A, right?
Yeah.
Now the first part is to realize that A versus A equals A inverse E, A because of the second one, right? So A is an identity from the right. But E can be written as by the third one, can be written as A inverse, right? A, right? But everything is associative, right? So I can like just reorganize the parentheses as I want. And I get that A inverse A equals A inverse A times A inverse A, right? So I've got, if I'm B equals A inverse A, I've just found an element in the group such that B equals BB, right? Such that B equals B squared. Now what I'm going to show is that every element that satisfies that has to be the identity. So if B equals BB, what we can do is multiply B inverse by the right of this both equations to both sides. So I get B inverse equals B inverse. And we have that this is the identity because of 3. And we have that this is the identity. So this equals E and this equals B. So B has B equal to E. So I just show that A inverse A equals E.
I think there's a much shorter way to do that.
Yeah, there is, but you know, I love this because I've never seen this. You want to do a shorter way? Yeah. Now, this is very nice. Thank you.
We have this, and we can multiply on this side, this, on this side. What is?
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
So we are multiplying from the left with A inverse and from the right.
So you're multiplying
this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you get B, B. No, wait,
how did you
second to the third? No, but the point is that you have that A inverse.
Oh, you can use that, yeah. Yeah, but then you have the same problem, right?
Yeah.
No worries, yeah. But there is they're all equivalent, but there is a simple one, which is, this is usually given in the textbook. So right? We can write that. And then we can say, okay, this is basically, E can be shown as A inverse multiplied by the inverse of this, right? Because this is, I'm doing the right multiplication by the inverse, right? And then by associativity, I have A inverse right. So this is E. But this is the right inverse of this, so this is E. Cool. All right, so once you've shown this, it's easy to show that the left identity, the right identity is also the left identity. Okay, so. Okay, the other comment I want to make is let's just say this. E is also the left identity. So there is no reason to call it left, right identity, or right identity. We just call it identity. Same with the inverse. Now the set G, you know, the set G can be finite or infinite. So, and if it is an infinite, it can be countably infinite or uncountably. And we'll see examples of all of these things. So if it is finite, if G is finite, then the number of elements of G is called the order, is called the order of the group, and I usually call it O of G. Other people call it different things. So, so group multiplication. So group multiplication is not necessarily commutative. So AB need not be BA. So there will be some cases, some elements which will be where the multiplication would be commutative. And for example, the identity element commutes with every other element, but it need not be. So this motivates our next definition. Which is abelian and non-abelian groups. So if all the elements of G commute, then G is a billion. If not, so if there exists at least two elements in G, two elements, say A and B in G, such that A times B is not equals to B times A, then we say G is non-abelian. You already know this, but you know, I just mentioned this for the sake of completeness. A very useful group, idea that we also need is subgroups. So suppose G is a group and H is a subset of G such that H forms a group under the same multiplication of G. Then we say H is a subgroup. Important to note that it has to be the same multiplication. You know, G can have a subset which is a group under some different multiplication. I don't care. That's not a subgroup. So H must also always have the identity element, of course. Otherwise, it would not be a group.
What about the identity element?
Yeah.
The same of the original?
It has to be the same, yeah. It has to be the same. Yeah, otherwise, you can show it has to be the same, otherwise. Sorry for playing with the. Okay. So there are different kinds of subgroups. So proper, proper and improper subgroups. So for example, both E, the identity element, and the whole group G, you know, they are trivially subgroups, right? Because the identity element is always a group by itself. You know, so such groups are known to be improper subgroups. So if H is a subset of G, but H is not E or H is not G. I don't know if this is mathematically the correct notation, but you know what I mean. I should probably say it's a set, right? Yeah. Then we say H is a proper subgroup. this is just a technical assumption to make sure that we are dealing with non-trivial things. So let's talk about some examples. So examples, the real line, right? The real numbers, they form a group under addition. So the addition is the group multiplication, right? So if I take 5 plus 7, that is 7 plus 5. So the plus sign here is the group multiplication. And what is the identity element? 0, right? 0 plus any real number gives me that same real number. So can someone tell me why it's not a group under multiplication?
Well, 0 doesn't have inverses.
Yeah, because 0 doesn't have a, you know, first of all, if it was multiplication, then your identity element will have to be 1. But then the element 0 doesn't have an inverse. So this is an example of a group that is that has infinite number of elements, and it's uncountably infinite, right? So another group which is also has infinite number of elements but is countably infinite is the group of all integers, right? And they also form a group under the same, basically under addition. A very like important and very frequently arising group, encountered group, is the cyclic group. So this is a very, you come across this group a lot. It's called the cyclic group Cn. And this consists of an element alpha and its multiple powers. By powers, I mean multiplying a squared means alpha times alpha squared means alpha times alpha. And the alpha raised to the power n is the identity. Can everyone see this? I won't go lower than this. So this is the cyclic group. So the cyclic group is always abelian, because every element commutes with itself. And notice that the cyclic group is generated, meaning that we can get all these elements by multiplying this one element to itself. So whenever a group is generated by a finite subset, by so if I can generate the whole set from a subset by multiplying themselves, that subset is called the generator, the set of generators. So here, this is a generator. Now, why does this group, is very frequently occurring, and why is that? Suppose you have a finite group, okay? Some huge, could be like 5,053 elements in it, right? And you take one random element, which is not the identity, and you keep just multiplying that guy, right? So what you're gonna do is you're gonna hop around the group, right? Hop around the set. But eventually, because it's a finite set, you know, it will come back to the identity. And there you go, you have a cyclic group. So it happens that for finite groups, there's always some subset, a lot of subgroups, which is the cyclic group. Okay? So it's a very frequently occurring group. Then let me give you an example of another group. I guess that's not working. You can call me Tibra.
Tibra. can we relate the basis of vector space to a cyclic group?
You'll have to have the if that vector space is the vector space of matrices, because usually for vectors, you know, the multiplication of two vectors don't give you another vector, right? So, but you can think of so if you think of the matrices as a vector, of course, then you can give it some sort of group structure because the multiplication is actually gives you some sort of group. If your matrix, if your set of matrices is large enough, I don't think in general no is my would be my answer. Like unless you have some more specific way of implementing why it should be associated with a cyclic group.
Because for a basis, you need a generator of basis. The basis
right.
Fine, like they generate.
Oh, I see. Right. So you're saying, okay, we have a vector space, and we have a basis, and then any vector can be thought of as being, you know, linear combination of that. I'm not sure, but I don't think so. That would be my gut reaction, but I might be wrong. But I don't think so, because you need. Because you know, for the definition of vector space, you don't need a notion of multiplication, vector multiplication, right? You need a scalar multiplication because you know, alpha. Because vector space are defined over some field, right? But the definition of vector space does not require multiplication of two vectors. Those are added on structures, right? That's why we call it's a Hilbert space is a vector space with such and such norm and blah blah, right? Okay, so far these groups have been rather trivial. We want to see more interesting stuff. So, for example, this is an example of Z4, and it can be Zn. And this is essentially the integers under modulo 4 addition. So this is the set 0, 1, 2, 3. And they also form an abelian group under addition. Okay. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. And you might say, why am I doing this? Because this is definitely something very, very trivial. So I'm sure all of you know about modulo arithmetic. But I can write this set, and then the addition table is right. So 1 + 3 = 4, but we are doing mod 4 addition, so that is 0, right? The reason why I write this because I want to introduce the idea of a group multiplication table. So if I say, okay, I'm going to label, say, E as the identity element as 0, A as 1, B as 2, and C as 3. This addition table can be written as a group multiplication table. Okay. So this is an example of a group multiplication. Table, and it only makes sense, you can only write it down for the finite groups, right? The discrete finite groups. And here, the identity element, so the group multiplication is essentially mod 4 addition. Now, I want to compare this with another group, which is part of a slightly more non-trivial, class of groups. And this group is called the multiplicative group, mod 5. If you were wondering whether multiplication, like multiplications of numbers, can be used as a group multiplication, here is your answer. It can, but you have to restrict the set in a certain way. So this is sometimes known as Z divided by 5Z times. So the general multiplicative group, the multiplicative group of mod, say, 10, it's actually quite involved to describe it. And I won't go into that, but you can talk to me outside class. So this group consists of 4 elements. And I write them as 1, 2, 3, and 4. And these are equivalence classes under modulo 5 addition. So basically, I take 1 and I take all the numbers, which are related to it by modulo 5 addition. Okay, clear? And similarly, I take 2 and I take all the numbers which are related to it by modulo 5 addition. For 3, group multiplication is basically given by this. Say, suppose you take 2 and you take 3, you multiply them. So what multiplication means is that you take one of the representatives of 2 and one of the representatives of 3, and it doesn't matter which one, you just multiply. So for the sake of, I want you to verify them more random examples, but let's just take 2 and 3. 2 and 3 is 6, and 6 falls into this class. So this is 1. Right. So what we can now do is that we can just now, again, draw a multiplication table, which is also a group. Is going to be a group multiplication table, but the multiplication table is 1, say 2, and I will be just a little bit cheeky and not write it in the order, right? Just like because I'm weird. Okay, and then, so 1 times 1 is 1, 1 times 2 is 2, 1 times 4 is 4, so So this is trivial, but then here, two times four is eight. So that's actually in the equivalence class of three. And then three times two is six in our mod. So this is one. And then this is four, three, one, two, and then three, one, two, four. Now, if I say, okay, if I label, of course, the identity element has to be this. But if I say A is 2, B is 4, and C is 3, and you replace all this by A's and B, we get exactly this multiplication table. So this towards the end of the class, I can bring out my secret weapon, which is the fourth blackboard.
Wait, so
yeah,
when you're doing that multiplication, you're multiplying the number in the brackets by the other number in the brackets, and then seeing where the result, which section the result is in?
Yeah, so, right. I mean, okay, this is bad notation. You're right. So what I'm doing is that when I'm saying I'm multiplying 2 and 3,
yeah,
I'm taking some element of that equivalence class 2, say I can take 12, and for 3 I'll take a single digit because I don't really know how to multiply big numbers. So say let's just take 3. Okay, so this is 36.
Yeah.
So now 36, you know, divides 5 divides 36. That doesn't divide 36, but you know, there's a remainder 1.
Yeah.
So 36 is 1.
Okay.
So what we've established is that okay, so this is an example. So they're the same group. So you can actually show that Z4 is also isomorphic to a cyclic group, and all these like multiplicative group of mod whatever is they are actually isomorphic to either some cyclic group or some products of cyclic groups. But we won't go there. So this is an example of group homomorphism. And if I have time, in tomorrow's tutorial, I will actually prove an important theorem. We will prove an important theorem about group homomorphism. So what is group homomorphism, formally? So so it's a map between G1 and G2 such that for all elements A and B in G1, we have so basically the multiplication structure is preserved. So note that the multiplication here in the argument is the multiplication of G1, whereas the multiplication between these two guys is the multiplication of G2. Okay. So if the map is one-to-one, then it's an onto, then the homomorphism is actually an isomorphism. There are important cases where it is not an isomorphism, and nature actually uses that in an essential way. We will see that the rotation group and the group known as SU2, which you know from as the rotation that acts on spin half particles, they are actually homomorphic, not isomorphic. And the fact, and it's a 2-to-1 mapping between SU2 and SO3, we will see that. And that actually allows for spinners to exist. So, so there are all kinds of really nice, beautiful physics related to this, to group homomorphisms. Yeah?
Doesn't it have to be continuous?
It doesn't have to be continuous because it can, for example, in our case, it's a discrete group. So the sense of continuity doesn't exist. But yeah, for Lie groups, yes, it should be continuous. You're right. All right, I'm done, but you guys have any questions? All right, if not, I'll see you guys tomorrow again.